opportunity to talk with community organizations, and then Tom and friends will be speaking at 7. So that is Friday, May 2nd at the First Unitarian Church. So, Tom, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Per. It's been a pleasure and an honor, and I am always so pleased to be on KBOO, and please get out there and contribute to KBOO. It's a great station.
And everybody get out there Friday and listen to Tom and his friends talk about what to do with this economy we're stuck with. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Per.
And coming right up on KBOO, we've got Gerald Friedman will be the guest, speaking with Kathleen Stevenson. He's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and author of Reigniting the Labor Movement. And he will talk about the economic benefits of single-payer universal health care for low-wage workers, unions, and community groups. Don't forget, it's Air Cascadia at 10 o'clock, at 10:15 Flashpoints, and at 11 o'clock, the Radio Zine features a discussion about the shootings at Kent State long, long ago, and with some Vietnam vets here in the studio. Thanks again for joining up with KBOO, those of you who have done it, and those of you who have not, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. It's 9:31, and you're tuned to KBOO.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. My guest is Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and author of Reigniting the Labor Movement. On May 17th, Healthcare for All Oregon will be hosting Gerald Friedman for a conference on the economic benefits of single-payer universal health care for low-wage workers, unions, and community groups. And Gerald Friedman will be on sort of a single-payer healthcare tour in Oregon for several days in mid-May. He will be in Corvallis on May 16th, and as I said, in Portland on the 17th. And you can get more about this on the website, hcao.org, Healthcare for All Oregon. Gerald Friedman, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you. Now, you are an economist, but you say that when economists got involved in healthcare in the U.S., that's when things started to go bad. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, economists think of markets as the be-all and end-all. And when they go looking for looking at a social problem, the assumption is that things aren't going right because we're not using markets enough. In the case of healthcare, prices were rising, some people weren't getting coverage, and they looked at healthcare in the late 60s, early 70s, and said the problem is that we basically have one insurance company, and people get the health the Blue Cross Blue Shield network, and people are getting their healthcare largely without paying for it themselves. Because there were very low co-pays and very low deductibles. Now, the problem with this approach is that when you open up for more competition, more insurance companies, when you start having more co-pays and cost sharing, when you treat healthcare as a commodity, there are all sorts of expenses that start arising, and all sorts of pernicious behavior. What economists call adverse selection goes on. If you have a choice of health insurers, you choose the health insurance plan that you think will work best for you, which means that people end up choosing a plan because they might expect to get sick. And then insurance companies start trying to regulate what you do to try to restrict this adverse selection. And they start hiring more and more bureaucrats and more paper pushers to monitor what goes on, to supervise the doctors and make sure the doctors aren't over-prescribing. And when you raise copays and deductibles, people stop going to the doctor when they're getting sick, and so they end up getting sicker, and it becomes more and more expensive to treat them. So what we see between the United States and the rest of the world is after we started doing this competition and more copays and more cost sharing, that's when our costs started to rise more steeply relative to other countries that just had things like Canada, which at the same time in the late early 70s went over to a single-payer system. Their costs have risen much more slowly than ours. They don't have the same administrative burden that we've developed. They have lower costs for billing and insurance-related activities, and they have better health outcomes. Their life expectancy has risen faster than ours.
And so what would be the history of the amount, the percentage, and I'm not quite sure of the figures on that, but the percentage that we paid for health care or health care insurance, say, in the late 60s compared to now?
Well, in 1971, that's kind of an interesting year to start with, because that's when President Richard Nixon proposed HMOs, and the government started to encourage the development of the health maintenance organizations in the U.S. And in Canada, that's the year they adopted what they call Medicare. They call it that just to tease us, because it's a universal single-payer system that they have up in Canada. And that year, both the United States and Canada were spending 7% of our gross domestic product, 7% of our income, on health care. In Canada now, they have longer life expectancy than us, better health outcomes, and they're spending about 11% of their income on health care. While we, with worse health outcomes, are now spending 18% of our income on health care. So we've gone from the same as them to almost twice as much. We're spending almost twice as much as they do for less.
And do you... go ahead.
And almost all of that difference between us and Canada now is explained by the more rapid growth of administrative expense in the U.S. healthcare system. You know, most hospitals have more people doing billing than they have beds in the hospital. You know, I mean, it's like the amount of administrative waste that goes on is staggering. You know, and if you look at a hospital bill, you can understand. I mean, they're like 20 pages long, and who can figure them out? But, you know, all the different billing codes, all the different insurance plans, all the different companies, and it's all set up to restrict what doctors do and prevent adverse selection in the insurance market.
Yeah. And so we put the Affordable Health Care Act into the equation, and what happens with the expenses of health care in the U.S.?
Well, it will help some. The Affordable Care Act puts restrictions on administrative overhead. The restrictions are at a very high level. For example, traditional Medicare has administrative costs of less than 2%, so that over 98% of what you pay into Medicare goes out in benefits. The Affordable Care Act limits administrative overhead in insurance companies to between 15% and 20%. So, yeah, that's a pretty high level already. But it will help, because there are companies that have more administration and they have to pay money back. You know, some people listening to us may have gotten a check from their insurance company last year. You know, they were, in effect, fined for having too much administration. So that will help. And it will provide coverage to most people. It will reduce the proportion uninsured by over half. And that will reduce, you know, the adverse selection issues. And insurance companies are not allowed to discriminate against people for pre-existing conditions. They're going to find other ways to drive out people who might get sick. So, you know, but there'll be some help, some reduction in administration. Overall, the White House projects that costs will fall by $800 billion over 10 years because of the ACA. That sounds like a lot, $800 billion, but it's out of $40 trillion that we'll spend on health care. By contrast, if we were Canada, we would be spending, we would be saving about $20 trillion out of that $40 trillion. You know, so $20 trillion with single payer versus $800 billion saved from the Affordable Care Act. You know, I mean, the Affordable Care Act is good, but it just doesn't go very far.
Is that why you call it a qualified failure?
Yeah, exactly. It's a qualified failure, or it's the last bad idea. You know, Churchill supposedly said, and I've looked this up, I've never found actually that he actually said it, but a lot of people say he said it, Americans always do the right thing, but only after they tried everything else.
I'm speaking with Gerald Friedman. He's professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, and he's coming to Oregon in mid-May, basically on May 17th here in Portland for a conference on Healthcare for All. Oregon is sponsoring it, and it's on the economic benefits of single-payer universal healthcare. So I think you've kind of said it, but what else would you say about how single-payer would rein in out-of-control costs of the growth that we're seeing in spending on this area?
Well, it would, making it impossible to screen people for your insurance plan. It would eliminate, you know, by putting everybody into one plan, it would eliminate all the money that's being spent now on advertising, on targeted advertising. You know, companies, you know, my father was in the coffee business when I was growing up, which I guess might be a popular topic in the Pacific Northwest. And he wanted to sell better coffee. He wanted to sell people coffee that was better so that they would buy more of his coffee and he'd make more money. That's not the way insurance works. Insurance, you work, health insurance, 70% of your expenses, 70% of the medical costs that people go, that people incur, go to 10% of the people. Most of the time, most people are healthy and they don't go to the doctor. Occasionally something bad happens and then you run up big bills. Insurance companies want to anticipate who it is who's going to get run up one of those big bills and get them to go away. And a lot of what insurance companies do is targeted at getting rid of people who are going to become sick, finding out who they are and getting them to leave. That all goes away with single payer. With that, you know, and with the consolidation of billing down to one company, most of the billing and insurance-related activities that go on in doctors' offices disappear. The average American doctor spends over $80,000 a year on billing and insurance-related activities. Nationwide, if we had single payer, we would save, first of all, $200 billion in insurance company costs, administration, over $200 billion on billing and insurance-related activities in doctors' offices and hospitals, and a single-payer system would also be able to beat up on the drug companies because they exploit their market power to charge prices that are about 60% higher than the world levels. I spent last semester on sabbatical with my wife in Rome, Italy, and Florence, and one of our daughters visited us. On the train up to Florence from Rome, she got sick. Or she was feeling sick. We ended up at a hospital, Santa Maria Novella, the oldest hospital in Europe, with a Fra Angelico fresco on the wall. And it's beautiful. And right next to the Duomo. It's wonderful. I recommend it. Go there for the hospital. Leaving, my wife asked the doctor, who didn't speak very much English, how do we pay? And he said, finito, finito. And, you know, she waved her credit card at him. He said, ciao, go away, done, finito. So she found a nurse who spoke some English. And the nurse said to her, Italian hospitals, no charge, not like America. Mm. Which means they don't have 450 people doing billing the way they do at Massachusetts General. So they give me two prescriptions to fill. I know, because I spoke to the pharmacist in Amherst at CVS, that these prescriptions would have been about $60 in the United States. I take them, I find a pharmacy, I go in, they fill them right away because they don't have to call the insurance company. And I'm thinking, I'm going to be hit with $100 or something on my credit card and I'll never get the money back from my insurance company. €13 for the two prescriptions, or $16. Why are drugs so much cheaper in Italy? Because they have a single payer that buys in bulk and beats down the prices to something more reasonable. And if you want a model for that, the Veterans Administration in the United States pays drug prices about the same as in Canada. We could all benefit from that. You know, the VA buys drugs at 41% on average cheaper than the rest of us pay. That would be over $100 billion saved to the American public. So we're talking about saving, with single payer, about $600 billion for the whole country. Or for Oregon alone, if you had a single payer system in the state of Oregon, which is possible, you could do it beginning in 2017 under the Affordable Care Act, you would save about 20% of your current health insurance, your health care costs. Next year, I anticipate Oregon will spend $42 billion on health care. With a single payer system, you would be able to lower that to $34 billion. That $8 billion you'd save would allow you to do away with co-pays and deductibles, extend coverage to everybody, including all the people still not covered by the Affordable Care Act, and you would still be saving $6 billion after all those benefits.
And how would we go about getting that by 2017 in Oregon?
Well, you do what is being done in Vermont, where the legislature last year, year before, passed a law, you know, planning for this process and then setting up a single payment authority, the Green Mountain Care Board, which will, there'll be tax revenues dedicated for this purpose, and everybody who wants to will be able to go into it. They'll set up a Medicare Advantage plan, so federal Medicare money will go into it, and a Medicaid-managed care plan. So everybody will be getting into the same health insurance system, one payer, and it will be financed through taxes. In the case of Oregon, I've estimated that you could have, with a progressive tax system, four brackets going from 5% up to 17%, over 95% of the people in Oregon would be paying less towards this system. You know, you could call it, Pacific Coast Care or something, or Pete's Coffee Care. I don't know what you'd want to call it. But you'd get, the single state agency. All bills would go to it. Everybody in Oregon would get a card with a little magnetic strip, or you could be modern and get a chip embedded in it. You go to the doctor, they swipe your card, or they run it into their chip reader. They type in what you're there for, the diagnostic code. A check would be cut by the state agency to compensate the doctor or the hospital, and you walk out. You're done. You know, and you take your card, you pay for your drugs the same way. No co-pays, no deductibles. You're sick, you go to the doctor. This would save thousands of lives nationwide. And hundreds of lives. Well, unfortunately, I didn't yet finish my calculations for Oregon of how many people's lives would be saved. By the time I'm there on the 17th, I have to save something for the audience. I'll be able to give you numbers of how many people's lives would be saved if we eliminated all obstacles to health care. Because in Oregon now, if you look at counties, mortality rates are almost twice as high in, or 70% higher in poor counties than in rich counties. And much of that is because of the difference in access to care. Counties where more people have cost-related problems getting to the doctor or filling prescriptions, those counties have much higher mortality rates, as much as double age-adjusted mortality rates in counties where people have, in Oregon, have trouble getting to the doctor because of cost. Nationwide, about 40% of Americans last year reported problems seeing a doctor or filling a prescription because of cost. Oregon is, you know, is better off on that. Your rate is closer to 25% reporting some problem getting to the doctor because of cost. But it's still, I'm sorry, it's 14%. So Oregon really is much better off than the rest of the country. But it's still a major problem in some counties. In Baker County, for example, 20% of the population reports that they had trouble getting to the doctor because of cost. And there probably are 120 people, extra deaths in Baker County last year, or the year before, 2012, because they had trouble getting to the doctor.
And you predict that in 5 to 10 years, we're going to have a choice between a popular movement for health care and a movement to keep paying the insurers. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, you know, you look at the Affordable Care Act and the projections from the Congressional Budget Office and the White House for the effect of the Affordable Care Act on cost. Healthcare spending will continue to increase at a rate significantly higher than the growth in income under the Affordable Care Act. If you go back to 1971, where we started, 6% of the average person's budget, 6% of income for the average American was going to healthcare. The average American worker, to pay health insurance premiums. Health insurance premiums are now closer to 20% of income, 20% of wages. And they're going up. They'll be like 25% in another couple, in another 5 or 7 years. We can't afford to continue in this direction. You know, we just can't keep cutting other things to find money to pay for health insurance. Especially since so much of it is going not to health care. We're not seeing the doctor more. In fact, we're seeing doctors less often. We're paying for the administrative bloat in the system. So there'll be another popular movement, and we'll build on the Affordable Care Act. Under the Affordable Care Act, you know, a lot of the people who don't have health insurance now will have health insurance. There'll be some improvements. So the issue isn't going to be so much access. Coverage, but it's going to be control and costs, because the Affordable Care Act, as I said, does not control costs in any meaningful way. How can you control costs? You can either go after administrative costs, which are over a third of our current healthcare spending. You add in inflated drug prices, and you're getting close to half of our healthcare spending now, and about half of it in 5 or 7 years, going to drugs and administration. You could go after those, or you could go after doctor services, provider services. We've been having this debate in Massachusetts. And so far, you know, and a law was passed 2 years ago. Fortunately, it doesn't have much teeth, but it's clearly directed at trying to discourage people from going to the doctor as a way of controlling costs.
And that's under Romney Care?
Yes, yes. And I think that's the direction the rest of the country will be looking in 5 years, 5 or 7 years. Because the Affordable Care Act is basically Romney Care for the whole country, which, you know, I support it. It's a good thing. There's a lot that's very good in it. But if we don't control costs, then we're going to have to make a decision at some point. Will we control costs by restricting monopolistic pricing and excessive administration, or will we control costs by keeping people from going to the doctor?
right.
and filling prescriptions. And, you know, I think the public, when faced with that choice, will make the right decision, just like Churchill supposedly said. You know, Americans will make the right decision.
And
eventually.
And right now, as far as working on this and getting some kind of response, a popular response or a response from Congress, what's the situation with that right now?
Politically, Congress is hopeless. It's almost incapable of doing anything. The partisan divide, or the Republican divide, I don't want to blame the Democrats as much, but anyway, Congress is hopeless. The Republicans are impossible, and the Democrats are in a bunker. You talk to Democrats, liberal Democrats, supporters of single payer, and they just won't do anything about health care right now. They're like, we passed the Affordable Care Act. We lost control of the House because of it. That's how Democrats see it. There's probably other things going on, but that was certainly part of it. We're getting beat up on this thing. We want to get that law in place and get the benefits, and then we'll talk. But that's in a couple of years. Until then, Democrats don't want to talk about it. They just want to rally around the president and the Affordable Care Act and just leave it at that, which is fine. You know, we can spend a couple of years working out the Affordable Care Act while we educate the public about the alternatives, and the better alternative being single payer. It is possible that things can be done on the state level, though.
Yeah.
While Congress is impossible, there are people on the state level who are more open to possibilities. And this isn't just Democrats. It's not just lefties. Because business is getting killed by health care costs. And I think Rotary clubs, small businesses especially, because they pay the highest premiums, would benefit enormously by a shift to single payer. If we transfer the costs of retiree health insurance, we transfer to the public agency through a single payer system, if we lower premiums, because the costs of health insurance, the tax burden would be way lower than premiums people are paying now. Businesses would be able to hire people without thinking about whether they're going to be expensive to insure. Nowadays, if you have any relatively small business and one person gets sick or one family member gets sick, it can jack up premiums for everybody. I mean, this is a very, businesses have to spend way too much time worrying about health insurance, thinking about health insurance, and they pay way too much for it. Single payer would do away with all that. So I think this is an issue that eventually Democrats and Republicans will come around to.
So in Oregon, we maybe could work on, trying to get something locally or in the state on a statewide basis in a more immediate way than the national movement for a single payer.
Yeah, you could do it. You could do it in Oregon right now. Well, it couldn't go into effect until 2017.
Mm-hmm.
The Affordable Care Act prevents states from doing anything outside of the Affordable Care Act until 2017. And at that point, you could get a waiver from the provisions of the Affordable Care Act if you establish that your alternative is cheaper and covers more people than the ACA. And I think that would be very easy to do for single payer. As I said, it's what Vermont is planning to do. And I think what we're going to see is that as states like Vermont, maybe Oregon, maybe New York, maybe Massachusetts, as some of these states make the transition to a single-payer plan over the next 5-7 years, they'll set an example for the rest of the country. People will say, my God, I want to move my business to this state.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much cheaper. And I want to move to this state. I won't have to worry about health insurance. And my costs will be lower, and everything will be so much better if only I lived in Vermont or
Right.
Oregon.
So, Gerald Friedman.
That's what happened in Canada.
Yeah, okay. Well, Gerald Friedman, I want to thank you very much. We're out of time, but very, very interesting to hear an economist talk about this from this perspective. Thank you so much. And again, you will be in Oregon in mid-May, and you will be in Portland on May 17th. It's part of the Healthcare for All Oregon Conference. That's hcao.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
You too. This is Kathleen Stevenson. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia with Chris Andre.
It's 10 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia after one announcement.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 15th annual Oregon Global Cannabis March on Saturday, May 3, 2014. Portland participants will gather in Pioneer Courthouse Square to march at noon through downtown Portland. Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer will be speaking immediately following the march. The rally will also feature other speakers and live music. Again, that's the 15th Annual Global Cannabis March, Saturday, May 3rd at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.